is Children Come First with Dr. Daria Brzezinski, WAAT 750 AM on your radio dial. Every Tuesday we're here from 10 to 11 AM, and we're here this morning with Jeff Golitz from the Institute of Heart Math. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
And it's an early morning in California, which is where the Institute of Heart Math is. And Jeff, you are Director of Education and Family Programs at the Institute of Heart Math. I want to get a little bit of background about what heart math is for our listening audience. Would you mind doing that for us?
Sure. Heart Math is a research and training organization. We're located in Santa Cruz County in between San Francisco and Monterey, California, and we have about 80 folks on staff. We're divided into several companies, a publishing company, a nonprofit research organization, and the entity I'm identified with, which is HeartMath, which is largely training and research. And we've been in existence for about 10 years, and largely what we do is we work with many sectors of population, if you will, from large corporations to state and federal governments to my area of passion, which is schools, to hospitals, etc. And we help these populations reduce stress, be more proactive in the face of change, and strategize how they can be more efficient and innovative for their people and for their organizational objectives. And in essence, our odd-sounding name, HeartMath, and as I joke with audiences, we are from California. We really believe in the power of the heart. We believe in the power of the heart both physiologically, we believe in that emotionally, and we certainly believe in it intuitively, that in this cognitive, information-driven world, that we need more heart, but not in some syrupy, sentimental way, but the real essence of who a person is, their core values, that which they believe in, and how to integrate that with the best functions of the mind so people can perform and live better in this fast-moving time.
Now, you are HeartMath. There's a book for our listening audience. It's called HeartMath Solutions by Doc Lou Childer, and you can find it in any popular bookstore like Barnes & Noble. It is an incredible book about the HeartMath solution to our ever-changing information age and how we can get back in touch with our heart. Let's talk about the research at the Institute of Heart Math. What kinds of research have you been doing and what have you found with relation to the correlation between the heart and the mind?
Well, it's just the whole, just paint a picture first. If you remember, George Bush in 1989 proclaimed the 1990s as the decade of the brain, meaning that there was just large bodies of research just unwaiting to be discovered on how the brain works. And of course, that research has been done, especially helped by PET scans and MRI scans, where they can look at the brain live and look at its various functions, from gross and fine motor skills to emotional states to thinking and analytical states. So the research in the brain has been really, really helpful because it's helped educators and parents, let alone other people, find out how the brain best works, what helps, especially in early childhood, for the brain to have optimal function. We know that the brain needs nutrition, oxygen, safety, and it needs emotional nurturing for it to unfold in a healthy way. But what a lot of researchers did not anticipate is, in researching the brain, what they found out is that indeed the brain is not only the only source of intelligence, if you will, but quite literally that we are rewriting our biology textbooks as we speak, because some of the properties of the brain, its nervous system, its distribution of neurons, the brain cells, ganglia, etc., we are finding those similar conditions in other parts of the brain. It's what's called distributive intelligence. That, in other words, we find neurons and neuron sensori, if I'm pronouncing that right, in the spinal column. We find it in the heart. We find it in the gut. namely that the brain is not the only intelligence in town, if you will. It's the dominant intelligence. It's where 80% of our cortex resides, our thinking, planning, analytical skills, but that there are other parts of our physiology that indeed are affected by perception and emotion, and indeed even have memory. So to answer your question, our research is really centered around the heart, and we did some research that was eventually published in the American Journal of Cardiology that found it looked at different emotional states. We looked at, let's say, anger compared to care, and what we found is that the rhythms of the heart change dramatically depending on our emotional state. We found that with anger, the rhythms of the heart through a measurement called heart rate variability, we found that the variable rhythms of the heart were jagged and disordered, or what they called incoherent. It's almost like you have one foot on the brake and one foot on the accelerator of your autonomic nervous system. The heart doesn't like that. It gets compressed. In contrast, that with, let's say, an emotional state like care, where the rhythms of the heart show these beautiful rhythms and waves and order. They're called coherent states. And so, indeed, the heart registers perceptions of the brain, and it doesn't just sit idly with those rhythms, but those rhythms are actually sent back up to the brain, and they affect brain function. Such that the Lacey's, a pair of research in the 60s who first came out with this information, say that it's if the heart had a mind of its own, and indeed it has these functions called cortical inhibition. I mean, the cortex cannot function as well, as opposed to cortical facilitation, that the brain functions better when the rhythms of the heart are more ordered, and of course that has all sorts of ancillary functions like the hormones and the immune system, and much more detail than I can cover in this hour. But indeed, the heart is communicating to the brain, and this is not just our body of research, but it's a growing body of research called neurocardiology, and a lot of this is documented in the book HeartMath Solution.
Now, I learned when I was at HeartMath that the heart puts out much more energy than the brain does, like 5 watts compared to the brain, which puts out like 0.5 watts. Is that correct?
It's something akin to that. I don't look at the watts total as much as I look at just the electromagnetic power of the heart. In other words, the heart generates about 40-60 times greater electrical power than the heart. And so, such if you measure the electromagnetic power of the heart, and for those radio listeners, electromagnetic frequencies are really what we catch when we turn on a radio station. It goes from a transmitter to your radio station, a radio tower to your radio station. So that's electromagnetic frequencies, if you will. Well, the heart also generates electromagnetic frequencies that are much, much greater than the heart. And in fact, what's interesting, and this is well known, it was documented by the Menninger Clinic probably 40 years ago, that the electromagnetic frequencies of the heart, every time the heart beats and contracts, it sends out an electrical signal. And that signal goes to every cell in the body, and it's not confined by the skin. It actually travels outside the skin, some 8 to 12 feet outside the skin. And I'm not talking about auras here. I'm talking about very measurable, very tangible electromagnetic frequencies measured by a magnetometer, the same equipment that measures the frequencies or the wattage amperage from a radio station. So the heart has this great power, if you will, and in fact, when you try to measure the brain waves, you have to suppress the heart waves because it's that much more powerful.
Wow, that is incredible. And so what you've explained to some of us is the fact that when we walk into a room, what literally happens is that we come in touch with this energy field around people, and we literally get in touch with that we sense it and we feel it, and so that gives us our impressions of people. Even we don't even know where we get these impressions, but it's actually the electromagnetic energy that's filtering into us, and we're sensing and picking up at some level.
Well, I think it's an influence. We've got to be careful here of not pushing the envelope too far. We know that certainly our language, our moods, our body language influence our communication to other folks just besides our verbal language. But what's being suggested here, and there's a lot more research that needs to be done, is that our emotional and perceptual states, we speculate, can be communicated to another person. For instance, you walk into a room and there's been an argument between two people and you just sense that. How do you sense it? Well, we don't know exactly. I guess that's what's called intuition. Even before the body language, in contrast to where you walk into a room and two people have been kissing, and what, granted, they're starry-eyed, and there seems to be this sparkle coming from both their faces, we also sense maybe an atmosphere in the room. So there's a lot more area to be explored as to this level of communication. Again, we're not talking about auras here. We're talking about very tangible electromagnetic frequencies. But boy, it's indicative of we operate more than just on our body language alone.
You at HeartMath have many, many incredible findings that I discovered quite interesting when I was there. And to our listening audience, HeartMath is in Boulder Creek, California. If you would like any information on HeartMath, you can call 1-800-450-9111. That's 1-800-450-9111. They do have training programs in what's called the freeze frame technique. Would you explain to our audience, Jeff, what freeze frame is?
Sure. And again, let me paint a little backdrop. We are almost compelled these days in our modern world, whether we live in the country, the suburbs, or the city, to find greater sense of balance, because probably the number one challenge among many, many people is lack of time. We simply have more to do in a less period of time, and especially in the educational field, more accountability, and oftentimes even less dollars. So we're all feeling a little bit more rushed, and this even trickles down to children. So we're compelled in this day and age, as I said earlier, to find some balance, to reduce our stress. For some of us, it's a feeling fatigue. For some of us, it's overwhelm. For some, we just get irritated by all the little nuances and triggers of day-to-day life, not just the big things like loss of a loved one or changing a job, which are all, they are stressful as it is, but the little stresses, the bad news, if you will, that comes over our three great news mediums, the newspapers where there's horrible stories, traffic, a bounce check, name it, all the little things that add up to our day-to-day. And what we found is that people are not handling that very well. While many of them have moments of peace and all that, we're finding that more and more people are stressed out. And so we've developed some tools to help people have more resiliency to face stress more proactively. And I'm talking about, by the way, when I talk about stress, I'm talking about the downside of stress. We all like a challenge, of course, to accelerate our performance, to kind of reach our potential. But I'm talking about the stresses that sort of erode our sense of balance in life. And so freeze frame is this very simple tool you can use in the moment where you recognize stress and you take a timeout, you freeze frame. It's almost like a basketball coach calling a timeout when his team has lost the momentum or needs to re-strategize. And you quite literally, step two, you shift your focus from the racing mind or disturbed emotions or whatever your preoccupation is or your anger or frustration to the area around the heart, almost like you're going to do the Pledge of Allegiance.
Oh, it's just an amazing technique in order to be able to learn to be calm. And I think we get ourselves all entrenched in our emotions and forget that we can supersede those and take control of a situation, and that's what freeze frame technically does. You are listening to Children Come First on with Dr. Daria Brzezinski, WAAT, 750 AM on your radio dial. We're here every Tuesday from 10 to 11 AM. You may call us at 570-639-2931. That's 570-639-2931. Or email us at prokids@rlc.net. That's prokids@rlc.net. You can also call Jeff at HeartMath at 1-800-450-9111. We're talking about HeartMath and the HeartMath solution from Boulder Creek, California. And we were just talking about, and HeartMath Solutions, by the way, is a book by Dr. Lou Childer that you can find in any major bookstore. Let's go back a little bit to some of the programs, some of the techniques that you are teaching people to overcome. And it's really a shame that we have to teach us all something that probably was instinctual at some point, but now we're having to relearn. Let's look at one of the functions called overcare. What is overcare in the realm of emotions?
Well, everybody cares about something in their life. They care about a child, a parent, and a pet. They care about their house. They care about their garden. They care about the world. And it's that care that sort of keeps us going. It's sort of like the glue that keeps our communities together outside, let's say, our legal structures. You know, some people call it morality. Some people call it a sense of right and wrong. But I'm even talking about a more kind of a mundane, we care about something. And when we care about something, we put a lot of motivation and effort to make these things or these people better, if you will, for our own satisfaction or even for the satisfaction of the people or things that we're taking care of. But what happens, there's this very fine line that our care, if we get too identified or worked up about something or someone, it slips into what we call over-care, and such that the gratification or satisfaction we had when we were caring, if that care crosses a line, we soon find ourselves getting stressed out about someone or something, and we might not even recognize the signals because we're so used to caring about something, but it's a very depletive state, if you will. It depletes our energy, and you know, typically, you could worry about your performance. Gosh, how am I doing? I just said something. You replay the conversation over and over again, and you're not even present with a friend or with an event, or if you're engaged in something, your energy is divided, if you will. I guess in modern culture, we call it neurosis. It's a split self, and everybody has some degree of overcare, but a lot of people have a great deal of overcare, and you could see it most in graphic examples like the kind of the archetypal Little League dad, who's got way over-involved with the game, and he's yelling and shouting and cheerleading his son on, but it's crossed the line into abrasiveness and yelling at the opposing coach, and even the son feels a little embarrassed by it, and the dad gets way, way worked up and loses perspective. That's what happens when we have overcare. Now, I'll give you a little simple example from my life where I was going to design a parenting program, or redesign a parenting program for a large government agency in a large western state, and I had a verbal handshake with the director of the curriculum development, and this person didn't call me back after several days, and I drove many hours to this person's site, shook their hands many times, read a great deal of research on what would be an appropriate curriculum, and this person didn't call me back. And I really wanted to do this. I was quite excited about it. And after the third phone call and there was no response, I'm starting to get impatient. And then my overcare, if you will, I'm obviously feeling distressed. And then it starts leading to blame. Well, she's just another senseless bureaucrat. They put on a nice face, but in reality, they really don't care. They're just part of a machine, and they're there to make their check and put on a happy face. But performance really is secondary. So I got all worked up, and this went on for a couple weeks, and I finally just dropped it and said, well, just forget it. But it wasn't a clean forget it, if you will. I was still angry, and of course I was very self-righteous about it. I was right. I put out all this care. I made the agreement. They did not respond to what was a verbal gentleman or gentle person handshake. And of course, as I later found out, the lady came back to me very sorry, but said her department had been downsized greatly, and the whole parenting program was hung up in the state legislature. You do parenting at the high school, which is more appropriate for the rural and the suburb level, or do you do it in the inner city would say is middle school, when there's a likelihood of those young 11, 12, 13, 14 year old students getting pregnant. And so she was between a rock and a hard place, and here I'm sitting quite embarrassed about getting all worked up over nothing, and I was projecting like crazy because I wanted this project so bad. So that's a very bad state of overcare, and I tell that story today is a prime example where my perception was distorted, and that's what happens when it worked up in overcare. We get so worked up with our principles, and we get righteous, and we're the only one that cares, and why don't you care, and you're not responding, and we're really driving people away. Unfortunately, parents can do that with their children if they cross that line with their over-loving, their smothering love, if you will, and kids recoil from that. They pull away, and that oftentimes can send children into early adolescence.
I never really thought of, and I think probably many of the mothers listening today never really thought of the concept of overcare and the fact that you could care too much and really smother someone with your caring. And I think it's probably something we all learn. It's a habit, or it's a behavior that we learn from our own parents and the behaviors of our parents, perhaps not feeling good about themselves or not being centered in themselves and just constantly promulgating the behaviors that our grandparents kept on perpetuating. So it's a real issue for me. I mean, it was something really extraordinary for me to look at in terms of overcare and being a mother, because a lot of the, prior to learning about this, a lot of my behavior was based on guilt as being a single mother rather than on really genuine care and loving of my children, which meant loving and caring myself.
Well, it's a tricky thing. It's not an automatic way to behave, because yes, our parents have learned to sort of overcare or smother us. Many of us have our models there. In the same time, in this day and age when parents have less time with their children, my Lord, we want as much care as possible. So if one does have overcare and one can't help but have that, it goes with the territory, I think. At least acknowledge that one is caring, and oftentimes there's an absence of that just simply because our families, our parents are working so hard to maintain a certain income level, to bring a certain level of prosperity or security to our children. At the same time, if there is that smothering, there's that nagging, there's that worry or anxiety, that is being transmitted to our children unwittingly on our part, and can drive a wedge between our deeper love and our deeper care between our child and what actually children are receiving. So it takes a tool like Freeze Frame, where you pull on the power of heart and you deepen your recognition of the love that already exists there. It's a very, very fine balance, and especially when it comes to the preteen age and the adolescence, where it shows itself most. And again, you'll have an early departure from children in the preteen level. You have the proverbial generation gap anyway. Children need to, as adolescents, to find their identity and find the will, and they have to separate. And this occurs, obviously, around middle school for many of them. But what I've seen more and more is that as parents get busier, more preoccupied with making a living and extending themselves into their hobbies and less time to spend with their kids, as is the case for millions of parents, the overcare, the nagging, the expectations, and there are so many great expectations on kids these days, dramatically more so than, let's say, 20, 30 years ago. We tend to put that pressure on children, and they're not at an age, especially at the young elementary age, to really to give voice to, like, this is too much. I can't handle this. I've got all the after-school activities. There's pressure in school to raise my test scores. I've got to study more at home. And, of course, I've got all sorts of hobbies there's a zillion TV shows that I want, so this pressure has trickled down from the adult world to the child world, and overcare is one way it manifests as the teachers, as the parents put pressure on kids to excel. And there's this great big race on that's called, you know, it's a competitive world, and are you going to get the good grades? Are you going to be a high-performance kid? And while we as adults like to think we're raising the bar on performance with children, this is not a friendly time for kids to grow up in many ways, because this pressure is just, hey, where's the innocence of childhood, if you will, and where's the chance to play, to have the spontaneity of growing up. But as we as parents recall from growing up when things were a little slower and a little more innocent, Where's the creativity just to play in our own natural way without having reliance on these electronic toys or electronic media or having everything laid out for us from the break of dawn to late into the night when everything's scheduled, because there is so much to do. I mean, yes, there is a lot of adventure and a lot of opportunity, but we mustn't forget that innocence of childhood. And actually how the brain prefers that natural, spontaneous development, if you will, of childhood. So overcare is just one slice of the pie and sort of the larger picture of children growing up and the challenges of parenting and a lot of compassion on parents and many parents. The pressures are there to raise the bar of performance, and it's just, we've never quite had this kind of pressure. I like what James Comer from Yale University says. He says, this is the first generation in the history of the world where information is trickling down to the children, largely without an adult influence to mediate that type of information that comes down, such that children can access information on the playground, with their friends, even on TV, certainly on radio, types of information that really is inappropriate. They don't quite understand it, and yet the popularization of the material is easy to model, i.e. Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. You can imagine all the playground jokes that were going on with the upper elementary children and not really understanding the complexity or the maturity of those issues. So,
who were you saying had that access, the was talking about the adult filters and information?
Children.
No. Who was that person you mentioned? I'm sorry, who talked
Comer
about...
Comer of Yale University, C-O-M-E-R, James Comer, who runs a lot of community programs at schools around the country.
Right now we're going to take a break for our listening to our sponsors. You've been listening to Children Come First with Dr. Daria Brzezinski on WAAT Radio, 7:50 a.m. on the dial. Our guest today is Jeff Golitz from the Institute of Heart Math at Boulder, Colorado. We're talking about the brain-mind and heart interactions. You can hear us every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m. The show is produced by Earth Heart Foundation, a nonprofit organization with offices in Pennsylvania, Virginia, and New Mexico. You can contact us at 570-639-2931. That's 570-639-2931. Or email us at prokids@rlc.net. That's prokids@rlc.net. We will be back to you for our second half hour in a moment, and we will return with Children Come First. If you'd like to speak with Jeff Golitz, you can call him at 1-800-450-9111. We'll return in a moment.
And there's a particular area of the brain it's identified as the amygdala. The amygdala, it's a Greek word for almond. There's two of these little amygdalas, one in the right hemisphere and one in the left hemisphere. And the amygdala actually acts as the site of our emotional memory. So all the emotional memories we've accumulated throughout our years, the pains, the joys, the happiness, those act as little filters for every oncoming experience. In a way, you can say that our emotional brain is eavesdropping on all of our current experiences, looking for emotional significance, looking for some reference point from the past. Is this safe? Will I like this? Is this preferable? So we have these preferences, and it's plays a large guide in our decision making. Our decisions aren't just rational acts. We have we like something or we dislike it, or when it comes to, let's say, danger, is it safe? Well, oftentimes, for instance, if you're walking around at nighttime and you hear a noise, and quickly your brain activates your whole senses and you go into fight or flight. Is this safe? You need your body, you need your mind, you even need your heart to kind of pump up the heart rate, pump in more oxygen, get the sweat glands activated, get the adrenaline going. You need to be poised for danger. And of course, in most cases, the danger passes and you recalibrate. But what we are finding, and a number of researchers are finding this, is that when children have anxiety or fear or nervousness, it's the amygdala, the emotional brain, that's activated such that you suppress the immune system and you cannot access your great cognitive intelligence because you're in a state of worry or fear. A prime example would be, let's say, in a test taking. We've got this whole trend, of course. We've gotten quite fanatical about it from my point of view, and test taking around the country. While it's wonderful that we want to assess performance with kids, I think we get into rather frantic about it. And in the test taking atmosphere, many kids feel nervous and anxious and they get worked up. Well, guess what suffers when we undergo that type of process? Our ability to access our cognition, that which we've already studied. And so the mind goes blank a little bit. And of course, they've done a lot of research on test taking when children or adults are anxious, and they say that it depresses by 5%. But I don't mean to get off into a tangent there, but the emotional brain, the role of our emotions in our learning intelligence is great. In fact, if you look at how we make our decisions, how we navigate life, how we mediate our decisions, our interactions, how we feel, our social skills, our nuances, how we receive someone's frustration, our ability to respond effectively and skillfully. Our emotions play an enormous role there, that we can no longer shove emotions off into the closet and say, well, it's the kingpin of the cognitive rational brain that really is aloof, that it's the cerebral part of our lives that governs our perceptions and therefore our decisions. Indeed, that is not true. Our emotions play a great role. And what's interesting about this is that, as I mentioned earlier in the show, that our heart is very sensitive to our emotional state. And in fact, here's an interesting one. Every time our heart beats, there's a corollary cellular response in our amygdala. So the heart and the amygdala have a very close relationship. And so we can no longer ignore emotional states. We can no longer ignore the rhythms of our heart, the state of our heart, because that's, as I mentioned earlier, the heart is constantly communicating our emotional state to the brain. And in fact, there's even more neuronal traffic going from the heart to the brain than vice versa. So there's this whole exciting frontier of field of research going on, not just with the brain, but with the heart, the hormones, the immune state, that is really making us rethink what is intelligence. It's not just some isolated intellectual activity, although, again, that we can, let's not undermine that. That plays a large role, but there's other aspects of our intelligence at work here just besides our cognitive abilities.
Well, you've really made me think about several issues, and one is the fact that about 50% of our children are products of broken homes, and the statistics are even larger in major cities, which means that we have children who are trying to figure out what bed they're sleeping in, which night of the week, and who they're staying with that day, and often wake up and don't even remember where they are, much less who they are, which probably sets itself up in terms of the learning environment as a very difficult situation. And
the motions dealing with divorce itself and moving maybe from one house to the next, or even one city to the next, or one country to the next, probably has a very detrimental effect with regard to the emotional state of the child and hence learning, which is why statistically divorced children have a lower learning curve than children of intact families.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Well, you're absolutely right there, Daria. I can get quite specific with the Annie Casey Foundation, which does their annual Kids Count survey. And in that survey, where they looked at factors of at risk, like are the parents on welfare? Are they unemployed? Did they not finish high school? Is there substance or drug abuse? And the rather alarming statistics said that 1 out of 7 children have at least 4 of these at-risk factors. And of course, the great window of learning opportunity, which comes in preschool, if children are suffering from homes that have any one of those at-risk environments, and I forgot to mention one of them, which you just alluded to, which is single and or broken homes. Yes, the brain cannot learn as well if there's this surrounding child's development. And this is not a new story. It's been around with years and years. We're just researching it better now. We know what the implications are. That in fact, alarming stories that researchers have, as we learn how the brain grows and how it develops, this is a kind of an extreme example that took place in orphanages in Romania, where children 6 months to 3 years, they receive no human touch. They had food, and their messes were clean up, so to speak, but there was no human touch, no stimulation, no interaction, and to the alarm of these Harvard researchers, they found that their brains were one-third less in size than a normal, healthy child. So the brain does not grow well without love, without nurturing, without proper food. And certainly, go back to what we earlier said, the emotions play a large role. And what all the researchers are saying is that the stress of a parent unwittingly is being modeled to children. And the good thing about it is that there is this great resiliency in children's physiology. They do have the ability to fall down and get back up and do that repeatedly. And where we're excited about our research is that you can actually rewire the brain and the neural circuitry. What we've seen is because there's such a great power in the heart that if you generate more coherent or ordered rhythms of the heart, that can actually reset the autonomic nervous system, the large nervous system that runs between the brain and the heart and the hormones. So there is this great capacity for miracles, if you will, for rewiring the brain circuitry for even our emotional memory. Granted, it's much, much more difficult as we become adults or even young teens. So we want to get children we want to help children live, be resilient and healthy and generally happy, so their brains function best as young as possible. But hope springs eternal, as the old poem goes. So that's what's great about the research about the heart. There is this great capacity for resilience to recover. And when I even live my own life, day-to-day life, I'm going to fall down and make some mistakes and get stressed out. What I look for is, what's my recovery time? We certainly like that in kids, where we see them bounce back so quickly.
That's a great, great perception.
But likewise, can we as adults, can we bounce back from what we have, or are we preoccupied with all the complexities of life? And of course, children are receiving all this, and they're going, boy, that's what the adult model's like. And some of them, the ones I talk to, they don't look forward to adulthood because of that very aspect. They know that life is complex.
And large numbers opt out.
They want to prolong childhood as long as possible. Some of them do, because they see what's ahead of them, that a lot of responsibility. Adult life can be very serious. And certainly you work hard. You work hard at home. You work hard at work.
And we've kind of missed
it. Spontaneity is, boy, we've got to find that in ourselves as best possible, not just for ourselves, but obviously for our children. And we deeply love our children, most of us, so we can give them the gift of modeling that more and more and finding more balance.
I'm really grateful to you for giving us a perception of emotions and the heart in a non-fluffy, rather research, very tangible way, so that I don't think anyone has ever really talked about the heart and does not associate it with something quote-unquote airy-fairy, but this is really tangible evidence and research in respect to the unique qualities of the heart. Which, can you expand a little bit on the unique qualities of the heart?
Yes, just briefly. I know we're running out of time here, but I'll refer you to a man named Jay Armour with Dalhousie University in Canada, who's 1991 wrote a large textbook called Neurocardiology, published by Oxford University Press in England. And he's really the one, in a very non-fluffy way, who said, look at this, there's all this stuff going on with the heart, that the heart has all the, it has a whole nervous system, it secretes three hormones, it's a complete, it has all these sensory neurites. In other words, the information that the brain sends to the heart, or even the outside world, that the heart takes that information and recalibrates, because it has memory. Yes, indeed, the heart has memory, not just for a pump, but for neural memory. The heart has what are called LCNs, local circuit neurons. This is amazing research. Where do you find local circuit neurons? In the hippocampus part of the brain. What's the hippocampus? That's for long-term memory. So the heart has the capacity for long-term memory. I could go on, and I'll confine it.
Well, we have 15 minutes, so you can explain it.
I have 15 minutes?
Yes.
Well, oh boy. The heart secretes a hormone. It's called the balance hormone, ANF, and I want to mention what that is. It's too technical, but that hormone is secreted depending on our emotional states. And they are now actually beginning to innovate at some cardiology labs. Looking at ANF as a potential indicator for depression. You say you have a sad heart or depressed heart. Well, indeed, that's true, because this is beginning research, by the way, but it's quite exciting. It's clinical. They look at ANF as one of the three hormones that the heart secretes is an indicator of depression. So this is wild stuff that's going on here. It's pushing the envelope, and there are not a lot of cardiologists know about that. To mention what I said earlier, there's a new field in cardiologists called heart rate variability. Most cardiologists will know about that. Again, we're rewriting the myth, or what we previously thought was knowledge about 30 years ago. When we'd go into a doctor's office, we used to think that a nice even rate of heart rate would be healthy. Let's say we're 80 over 100, or our heart averages out at, let's say, 75. And doctors thought, you want your heart to be balanced like that from beat to beat. We don't want the heart to react too violently. We now know that is a complete myth, and in fact, it's a very unhealthy diagnosis on the heart. You want your heart to beat to have some variance, to have some variability, as it's called, from heart to from beat to beat. That's a sign of good health. Where they first discovered that, by the way, was early when children are first born. One of the indicators of heart rate variability is if their heart's range and speed of the heart. They go from, let's say, 100 to 140 in a matter of seconds. That's a very healthy indicator that the heart is vibrant, vitality. Now know that as we age, the heart loses that variability. That's a sign of aging. So you can maybe her heart varies in speed from 80 to 84 over a period of a minute. That is not healthy, because the heart has lost its flexibility to respond to life's environment. We want the heart to speed up when we're walking up hill, and then at nighttime we want it to slow down. We love that variance. And what we now know, and this is cardiologists, this is not just the Institute of Heart Math, is that if your heart rate variability, your ability for the heart to speed up and slow down is limited, if it narrows, that is not only a sign of aging, but it's a sign of sudden cardiac death. And of course, we see this out in California when there's those occasional earthquakes. and you have someone in, who's a senior citizen, or has been really working hard, 60-hour weeks, and maybe is has some kind of substance abuse or drinking problem like that. Boom, they have a heart attack like that. They're gone. There's all this pressure that's bearing down on them. Their heart could not handle it, and they have a heart attack. So. Heart rate variability is another great discovery. It was recently featured a couple months ago on ABC News. As once in a while, this great indicator of research comes along, and they even put it in the same category as X-rays. So it's called heart rate variability, and we do enormous amount of research on heart rate variability, and we even do it with. We just recently did a study with police officers, by the way, looking who have an inordinate amount of stress, and they're among the first to upon retirement to have high mortality rates upon retirement because they've been suffering for years with great stress, with high adrenaline and cortisol levels, let alone spousal relationships that suffer. So we measure their heart rate variability, and in this study, measuring some 60 police officers, there was about three that had very narrow ranges of heart rate variability. And in confidence, we had to tell these officers, without their superiors knowing, that they need to do something here because their heart rate variability is not healthy, and they're under a risk for suffering heart attack. So it's just one more feature that we now know about the heart. And keeping one other thing I'll add, and this has been known for a while, of course, that the heart is the first sign of life in utero, in the embryonic state, somewhere around the 14th to 20th day and when the embryo is being developed in the mother's womb. The heart comes along. We don't know why, but there's pulsation that happens, that needs to happen, that without that pulsation, there will not be cell reproduction. This is long before the brain has come online. Of course, it's the last to go. So there's something more about the heart than what we think. It's not just a mechanical pump. It's got all these other qualities, has a whole nervous system, secretes hormones, is doing a running commentary, if you will, on its physical, hormonal, oxygen states, and it's communicated back to the brain and can and influence brain function. This is shocking a lot of people, but this is the body of research that's unfolded. And here's another one, and this is off the scales, and but perhaps many of you have heard this. Excuse me. It was featured in a book called Heart's Code. And what this gentleman did, he's a doctor, he recounted all these examples of heart transplants. And these are wild stories. These are, again, not scientific, but all anecdotal. I think he had some 70 stories. One of them even turned up in Reader's Digest, where someone has a heart transplant, that heart is going bad, and someone has just had a major accident. The one who had the major accident donates their heart to a recipient. And the stories, and they're myths at this point. Again, it's not scientific, but there's a growing body of stories for what it's worth. So this is fun more than anything. But somehow, in the story of the heart transplant, the myth has it, the story has it, that whatever the personality characteristics of the heart donor were, when they're transplanted to the new recipient, there is some kind of transference of personality quirks. Wild stories. I'll recount one that was in Reader's Digest and certainly in the book Heart's Code, where unfortunately, a young pre-adolescent girl was murdered, and her heart was transplanted to another young pre-adolescent girl. Well, this pre-adolescent recipient started having nightmares. She started having nightmares of somehow seeing pictures, ghastly pictures of the murder of the donor, and she related to her mother. And she got quite specific as to who this person was that murdered the donor. And this eventually led to the arrest of the murderer. Now, that's a fantastic story. I mean, it's I think that stretches the credibility of all of us. But these are the type of stories that are emerging. That, so, as I said earlier, the heart has memory. Is the speculative? Very much so. But this is what we believe is going to be unfolding about the heart, as we're already rewriting our research understandings about how the heart influences the brain and even how the brain functions. And perhaps this type of information will unfold. Again, it's not scientific, but it is at the most intriguing, and I think it just shows you there's more to the heart than what we think. It's not just a mechanical pump.
What was the title of that book again? You were just referring?
Heart's Code.
And by who?
I am short on memory, on my own memory today. I cannot remember.
We did wake you up early in the morning. Now, this is just absolutely fascinating to me. You are listening, by the way, to Children Come First, WAAT 750 on your radio dial with Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're talking to Jeff Golitz from the Institute of Heart Math in Boulder Creek, California. I said Colorado earlier.
Frequently confused.
Yes. Children Come First is sponsored by CK Auto Supply, with locations in Moosic, Scranton, Pittston, and Kingston. You can visit them on the World Wide Web at www.ceekayauto.com. That's ceekayauto.com. In the last 4 minutes here, Jeff, do you think you could sum up the Institute of Heart Math, your work, whatever it is that you'd like to convey to our audience in summation about the heart and the brain-mind connection and the research that you've done at the Heart Math Institute?
Yes. As I said earlier, we're a research and training organization, and we've done a lot of published research on the heart, particularly how emotion affects the heart. That when you have, let's say, positive emotional states, the rhythms of the heart, through a measurement called heart rate variability, the rhythms of the heart become more ordered or coherent. In contrast to, let's say, we're feeling stressed out or angry or frustrated, the rhythms of the heart are more disordered or incoherent. And this, we believe, clearly affects brain function, that the brain functions better when the heart is in a more coherent, organized state. And of course, this fits our common sense. We know that when we're feeling good or clear, that the brain will function better, we'll make better decisions. We won't regret things we say or do, because our emotions are perhaps a little more disorganized. And we also do lots of training in all sectors of society, from large corporations to federal, state, and local government agency, to my area of passion, which are our schools and parent groups. We do large research interventions, let's say, with police, with middle school students, with diabetics, on performance with corporations. And largely what we're trying to do is help people reduce stress and bring more qualities of the heart, if you will, into their day-to-day life, so they bring more quality and quantitative performance into their work or home environments. And we're about 10 years old, and we're growing at leaps and bounds, finding more credibility. When we first started, you know, the heart was thought as just kind of a silly metaphor, or something syrupy, or vanilla white, or Hallmark card. And now, with all our research, and especially the amount of research that we've done, and that the brain research has done as well, people are finding, yes, we need more heart in our lives. And a lot of folks already kind of sense that intuitively anyway. We're just quantifying and mapping out on a physiological level what actually the heart does. And it's quite exciting.
I'd like to name some of the items that you have available. Jeff and the Institute of Heart Math are located in Boulder Creek, California. The number there is 1-800-450-9111. That's 1-800-450-9111. They have books like Heart Math Solutions, written by Doc, D-O-C, Lou, L-O-U, Childer, C-H-I-L-D-R-E. Also, the freeze frame book, They have parenting books. They have Teaching Your Children to Love and many other books. Heart Math for Teens. So there are a variety of different kinds of books as well as music. And we didn't even get to touch on that regarding how music affects children with ADD and especially the music that has been produced out of Heart Math, which is extraordinary with respect to getting the body in sync in the heart-brain connection. Thank you very much for being with us today, Jeff. We greatly appreciate your time and getting up so early in the morning to be with us from California.
Dari, as usual, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And we look forward to talking with you again. This is, you may reach Jeff Golitz at the Institute of Heart Math at 1-800-450-9111 for more information. That's 1-800-450-9111 for more information about the Institute of Heart Math. You have been listening to Children Come First with Dr. Daria Brzezinski on WAAT Radio, 750 AM on the dial. Our guest today was Jeff Golitz from the Institute of Heart Math, talking about the latest research in the brain and the heart connection. You can hear Children Come First on every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m. on WAAT Radio, sponsored by CK Auto Supply, with locations in Moosic, Scranton, Pittston, and Kingston. You can visit them on the World Wide Web at www.ceekayauto.com. This show is produced by Earth Heart Foundation, a nonprofit organization with offices in Pennsylvania, Virginia, and New Mexico. You can contact us at 570-639-2931. That's 570-639-2931. Or email us at prokids@rlc.net. That's prokids, P-R-O-K-I-D-S, at rlc.net. Join us again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. on WAAT Radio for Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. Have a good day and have a wonderful week.